This week, the Dow Jones Industrials finished at yet another 120-year record, while gold shares regained territory, rebounding from cyclical support. Well, welcome back, everyone. It's a pleasure to rejoin you this week, and we have another big Gold Seek show with two more top guests, including Bob Hoy from Institutional Advisors. He says that U.S. shares are reaching bubble territory similar to the 2000 bomb levels. And we discuss the cryptocurrency bonanza, noting that the powers that be have virtually zero ability to cap this market through naked short selling. And that's been a typical way that we've seen shares decimated in the past, including the year 2000 deluge, as well as many other individual shares along the way. They simply don't have the firepower, yet at least, to destroy this amazing rally, which might lead to what I believe could be the greatest tulip mania since the tulip mania. Then Gerald Celente joins the show. From the Trends Research Institute, he says geopolitical risks are ratcheting up. Gold remains the ultimate safe haven. He calls it thermonuclear bomb blast shelter. Much of the recent Bitcoin price explosion is directly tied, he says, to Japan's acceptance of the cryptocurrency as legal tender. Actually, several nations around the world are starting to wake up to the opportunity, as well as GoldSeek. That's right. We have BitSilver ICO. That's a cryptocurrency proposed offering. We know that the space is filling up quickly, and one source suggests that 10% of the $5 trillion Forex currency market could go to digital currencies. So we have brought ours to the ring. The first silver-backed Bitcoin that I can find, at least. We think Bitcoin is headed first to 10,000, perhaps on as high as 100,000 or more. We have lots of top folks in the area who agree with us. Jim Cramer's actually made a pie-in-the-sky call for $1 million, as we've mentioned on the past few shows. And we've talked about Vladimir Putin. He's talking with the founder of Ethereum. Tim Draper, the big billionaire VC at Silicon Valley, sees a $100,000 price tag on Bitcoin and $10,000 by next year, his target from a couple years ago, which seems to be right on track. My concept here is simple. Ethereum-backed tokens with 90% silver dimes behind the initial 10,000 are redeemable. Once it goes live, proposed ICO, the Ethereum tokens facilitate money supply expansion because there is voting rights. So you can theoretically increase the supply to 21 million. And by maintaining a limited money supply, we like to think the BitSilver ICO will have monetary soundness in tandem with relative anonymity of the digital currency. Early investors, which is really filling up rather quickly here, will receive top tranche of the tokens. And of course, as time passes, that percentage will drop off. So you want to be as early as possible. Each $100 investment is issued 100 tokens per 100 convertible. If you have any other questions, you can send them to gsr@hughes.net. And I should add the disclaimer here that this is merely a concept Ethereum-based token. So investment is 100% at risk. There's no guarantee of returns of funds. And the market will determine, of course, the exchange rate of this proposed ICO. Also, GoldSeek is excited to announce our new sponsor, Silvercorp, a mid-tier producer and sponsor of GoldSeek Radio for the coming year, ticker SVM. It announced that it would boost its dividend about 35%. And for complete transparency, our top gold analyst, Peter Spina, plans to purchase shares on a pullback. Shares look primed to fly as soon as next week. If I had any funds available, I'd probably start to build a core position right about now. And remember to sign up for the Alpha Stocks newsletter. That's where we offer a new portfolio each week with the best technically and fundamentally sound shares, almost all with dividends, as well as the cryptocurrencies are starting to become the topic du jour. And Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest report. You can call into our toll-free hotline at 1-641-715-3900, followed by our mailbox number 514049. Please jot this down on a post-it pad, 641-715-3900, mailbox 514049. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Mostly sunny skies hovered over the precious metals market on dovish comments from a key Fed governor this week. Both precious metals finished at the break-even point, with gold at around $1,256 and silver at around $1,665 an ounce. The precious metals XAU shares, though, flew higher 5%, finishing at $83.50. while black gold pulled back $2, about 4%, ending at $43. The top story pushing the precious metals higher this week lowered cost of mining on falling energy prices. Plus, on Friday, St. Louis Fed President James Bullard said the Fed can afford to stop raising interest rates and wait and see how the economy moves forward. One top pundit noted that August might just be a really solid month for a new uptrend in gold, and I think he's a month late. I think July is shaping up for a solid month. And I really don't expect any more Fed rate hikes this year. The current Fed funds futures contract at the St. Louis Fed indicates about even odds for a rate hike in December. Pretty strong odds for an increase to 1.25% to 1.5% by next year. But really, that's a bit much slower than folks had anticipated just last year. No big scare there for the precious metals sector. Although the Federal Reserve did increase rates last week of their benchmark overnight lending rate, and hint that it would be lowering its balance sheet. Again, there's just an uptrend unfolding at the Fed's balance sheet if you look at the Fed numbers. So more Fed rhetoric, precious metals, bottom line. You know, I find the solid price action in the XAU gold shares encouraging. The bulls have admirably held on to price support this week after a third consecutive test of the cycle lows. But the CRB commodities index has now entered a free fall, just as the U.S. dollar is starting to show some signs of life. Until the CRB in West Texas finds solid floor, I think the precious metals rally may have to hold off for a while. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility virtually unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange for the fifth week running on better-than-expected housing numbers and tame price figures. The Dow Jones Industrials finished at yet another all-time record, adding 66 points at 21,394. The S&P 500 added 5 points, finishing at 2,438, while the NASDAQ Composite added 114, finishing at 6,265. Lastly, the Bitcoin ETF picked up 10%, 40 points at 438. While the Komodo coin ended the first time over $2, gaining over 30% this week, just on fire. On Friday, government reports indicated new home sales improved over last month, a favorite leading economic indicator of mine that tends to give us hints of the overall health of the economy. Plus, inflation remains tame, presenting near-perfect recipe for solid corporate profits. Strong growth and low prices were indicated by the sluggish Purchasing Managers Index, which declined to a 9-month low in the latest reading. Bottom line on equities. Well, the technical outlook remains solid. Our favorite 7-indicator greed to fear index is still in nearly perfect neutral territory, set right at about 52. Few signs of frothiness, although there were some signs of waning momentum in the Dow and less so in the NASDAQ. Investors simply can't get enough of U.S. shares. Coming up after the break, more Gold Seek.
Trends researcher and publisher of the Trends Journal rejoins the show with his review of the mid-year Trends Journal report here, impacting the economy and our geopolitical arena. Welcome back, Gerald Celente.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you back. And you know, the Globalnomics report, that's your mid-year report. What grabs the reader, this is entertaining. This is the way that media was meant to be. Pundits call for the end of the printed media altogether. It's all going online. What I think is leading that charge is the Trends report. So let's talk about the wealth gap. You sort of start off the report with this wealth gap, and I think this is underreported in the mainline media. The Dow's hitting new highs every week almost. But in reality, we've got a major disconnect between the haves and the have-nots. We've got 102 million people who could be working for one reason or another have just given up.
Well, you look at the numbers. For example, when Obama was president, he was bragging that he created 10 million jobs. Yeah, he did. But according to the Harvard-Princeton study, 94% of those jobs are temporary work. You look at the numbers of millennials that are living with their parents because they can't afford to buy homes. It's over a third. You have 51% of the people in America having full-time jobs. Great. They're paying $30,000 a year or less. You have 8 people that have more money, more wealth, than half the world's population combined. We've never seen a wealth gap like this before. Under Trump's plan, to tax the very rich, it's about 35%. It's currently 39.5%. Under Reagan, it was 70%. Under Eisenhower, it was a 90% tax rate. So you have the Bezos, the Buffetts, the Bloombergs, the Zuckerbergs, with these multi-billion, the Gates, unheard of wealth, paying tax rates that are just way, way out of scale for what they're making. And then you look at the whole scam of all the, you saw with the Panama Papers last a year ago, April, and you're finding out all these offshore deals by the wealthies and the multinationals. But we, the little people, have to pay every penny in tax. So that's why you're seeing, again, what we made clear in this past election in the United States, it wasn't Trump the messenger. It was the message. And the message is that people are tired of getting shafted. So that's what this is really about, whether it's in the United States and whether it's the Brexit vote. That was another issue about it when it happened. When it happened over there in Italy with the five-star movement. All, by the way, these populist movements are losing progress, not because of the message of the movements, but the messengers. Again, with Le Pen in France, the same thing. But now they got a new guy in Macron who just came in, just had another election, and he's gotten all the power he needs. But he's pro-business, pro-euro, but then you look at the amount of people that came out and vote. 57% just stayed home last Sunday rather than going out and vote. And that's in a country where you get a high voter turnout.
Look at Venezuela, right? I know you've been following it closely. That's a serious economic situation you have there, and it's turning into a revolt. Any comments there?
No, sure. Again, what's their major export?
Oil.
What are oil prices doing? So now, as people know that subscribe to the Trends Journal, and we do a Trends in the News broadcast each weekday night, beginning June 2014, when oil prices were at $115 a barrel and they started to rapidly fall, we said this is the beginning of a long downtrend. People forget, and tracking trends is an understanding of where we are, how we got here, and where we're going. Saudi, our great ally, who the Wahhabis, who worked to overthrow Gaddafi, Assad, the Saudis said, what we're going to do is we're going to let these oil prices keep falling. And we're going to wipe out all of the smaller producers in countries that it's more expensive for them to get oil out of the ground. And it failed. Their strategy failed. So as we're speaking now, we're talking Brent from being $115 3 years ago in June to being around $45 a barrel. This is very important. Going back to Venezuela, major export, major income, oil, revolution. Brazil, Nigeria, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Kuwait. Look at all of the countries that rely heavily on oil as their major GDP income source. As the prices go down, internal combustion is going to heat up, and it's going to spread beyond the borders. That's what we're going to start seeing unfolding, and no one is putting it together. It's more than just a supply and demand problem. Because, you know, now the United States, in two more years, we're going to be producing more natural gas and oil than Russia. So it's not a supply and demand problem in the sense it's going to be, oh, all we need is the Chinese to buy more and we have to drive more. No, there's way too much product on the market, and it's going to get worse. Because no one is talking about all the alternative energy sources that are developed and developing in major economies, particularly in Europe, that are not using fossil fuels.
You know, our fracking industry is huge here, especially in the upper Midwest, and it's continued to be hit hard by this glut. Plus, we read that the number of oil rigs are starting to stack up and reserves are overflowing. So I think you make a great point there, because we were looking for $75 to $100 oil until this latest turn of events. Wanted to switch over to jobs, though. I like this title here, Lousy Jobs, Rotten Pay. You know, little progress, you say, made on the job front. We all had high hopes, but unfortunately, underemployment is a huge issue.
Yeah, it's because of a number of factors. And the greatest factor, of course, one of them is the manufacturing jobs that have been exported overseas, beginning primarily with NAFTA back in 1994 and just escalating, so you don't have middle class pay anymore. And I'll never forget the debate between Ross Perot and Al Gore, and when Perot warned of that great sucking sound. And the Clinton administration was bragging that you won't have those dirty jobs anymore, you'll have clean service sector jobs. Yeah, so now you can have a clean service sector job and you have that education that you're $70,000-$80,000 in debt for, you can get a job at Amazon, you know. Maybe they'll have a degree in packaging, you know, how you can package well. And so that's what's happened to the jobs. It's not only in the manufacturing outsourcing, more the monopolization of multinationals grabbing all the businesses. And this happened also because of the bailouts following the crash of 2008. So what's happened is since that, the bigs have become much bigger, and because of zero interest rate policy and negative interest rate policy abroad, you're looking at, well, again, just looking at Amazon buying up Whole Foods. They're getting money for nothing. Their stock is, what, about 200 times P.E. ratio? They're barely earning a profit, but they get money for nothing because they got all this dough and all this stock advantage. And so that what's happening is with the jobs, you're having more and more companies buy out other companies, whether it's in the news media with the newspapers or within the grocery chains. So what happens is they keep firing people as they consolidate. And because they control the market sector so strongly, they have no opposition. So they can pay their workers nothing. And that's what they often do. So when you're looking at people earning $12 an hour, $15, you can't live on that today. And those are the kind of jobs that we're creating. So we have a very serious problem that we don't see getting better.
Exactly, serious problems that aren't getting better. And you also discussed the midterm elections, and obviously there's going to be a battle here. It could be the economy that is the deciding factor. Tell us more, please.
Well, it is the economy. It goes back to that, you know, we were the only that I know of, unless there's another one, let us know, that predicted that Trump would win. And we did that in May of 2016. It's in black and white. It's the economy. That was the Clinton campaign slogan back in 1992. It's the same one now. So when you look at the last election and you look at the numbers, yeah, you know, well, Hillary Clinton got more votes than Trump. Yes, she did. Where'd she get them? On the East and West Coast. Those are more profit-making areas. Again, Silicon Valley and the East Coast, Wall Street and Silicon Valley. So you have more income generating coming. Well, you take a drive through the Midwest and parts of the South, you know, it's a day in Calcutta when you see all the boarded up small towns and you see the real poverty in this country. That's what's really going on. And as you see the cover of the Trends Journal, we have USA crossed out. We have DSA, Divided States of America. And it could not be clearer when you look at the economic disparity. And so that's what we're looking at here. And when the elections come up, the midterm elections, again, are going to be basically around the economy. That's the bottom line, and that's why Trump won.
I'd like to move on to the precious metals. That's our bread and butter here, and you outline in the Trends Journal that if the Fed continues to raise rates, it could boost the dollar somewhat. But the current Fed funds futures after this latest rate hike, we just had the last meeting, don't show very high odds for another rate hike this year. You see a downside at worst of 1100 on the yellow metal and maybe an upside of a break above 14, which could run to 2000 and beyond.
They're not going to do one in September, but we're forecasting they're going to probably do one. That's our best estimate. We would, you know, not staking our reputation on it because we're looking at very weak GDP numbers. So if the GDP numbers stay weak, they may not raise them again. But even if they do, it's not that big a raise. But it's going to hurt gold prices, no question about it, because there's the opportunity cost of holding gold. The more expensive, the higher rates, the more expensive it is to hold. So it's a downside risk on that. But again, as you said, we have a, you know, it was $1,100 is out. That's our approximate downside risk. But then you look at the global situation. the United States is ramping up the war in Syria. And by the way, it's against international law that we're even there. Well, them Iranians are there. Yeah, but they were invited by the government of Assad. Well, I hate that guy, Assad. Well, it's not whether or not you hate him. He was democratically elected by the people of Syria, and it was monitored by international observers, and the election was rated as a fair and open election. But those are only facts. So now the United States is a foreign power attacking a sovereign nation, shot down a Syrian jet this week, been blowing up Iranian drones. Iran and Russia were brought there by Assad. And if you go back to Donald Trump, when he was candidate Trump, he was talking about, we don't even know who these rebels are. I talk to generals here. Nobody knows who these people are we're supporting. Well, we're supporting more of them, giving them more money and more armaments. I'm saying this about gold. You look at one of our last trend releases. We believe the United States is going to instigate something with Iran. Of course, it'll look like Iran did it, whether it's with the United States and Iran or Iran and Israel. And by the way, Iran, who the United States calls the worst, the biggest supporter of terrorism in the world, has not invaded a country in 250 years. And it's the United States and its allies that have been supporting all these terrorist groups. We could go back to a guy named Jimmy Carter, the wonderful that brought us the Taliban and the Mujahideen to get the Russians out of Afghanistan for everybody with attention deficit disorder. And a wonderful guy by the name of Osama bin Laden. So it's not Iran that's been supporting the terrorists. It's been the United States that supported the terrorists to get Gaddafi out of office. And that thanks Clinton, Obama, Samantha Power, and Susan Rice. It's not Iran that's supporting those moderate rebels in Syria. It's the Arab League and the United States that are supporting these radical groups. What we're saying is gold is the ultimate safe haven in times of geopolitical conflict, and the heat is there as hot as it is in Phoenix. It's well over 100 degrees. And if anybody can't feel the heat, they better get out of the air conditioning room and stop listening to the propaganda, the one story they play on the Cartoon News Network and all the other BS networks, that the Russians are coming. The Russians are coming and not looking at the world. So that's why we're saying gold, we believe, and we don't give financial advice, is still the ultimate safe haven asset, particularly in these times of geopolitical and economic uncertainty.
Exactly, and I couldn't have said it any better. And, you know, I think another aspect of the gold story is that it's just unloved right now. It's out of favor. You know, there's always that potential to return to the mean. It seems to be waiting for just the right time, you know, for enough bulls to regain their confidence and start another stampede. But I'd like to talk about another alternative to the dollar, the dilution of the dollar, not just the dollar, but, you know, all the major currencies, you know, the ECB, the euro. Then there's the cryptocurrencies. You know, they're predicted to take up about 10% of the Forex currency space in the next decade, $500 billion. Can you tell us what the impact of those factors might be to the U.S. dollar and gold?
Well, now that Japan is, by the way, has allowed Bitcoin to be, you know, a legal currency for exchange. And that's why you saw Bitcoin prices rise so rapidly. And they went down for a while in China because they put restrictions on dealing. So that's the problem with cryptocurrency. We see a lot of value in them as a gamble and as an alternative to weakening currencies, but the governments could control them in a flash. And with gold, at least you can have physical possession of it. All you have is Bitcoin, is the air. And I don't care how good they think these computer systems are. Someday, somewhere, somehow, this thing could crash in a second. Everything you have is wiped out.
I think we're really circa 95, 96 internet bubble. I think we have several years to go on this bubble, but there's that part of me that remembers the 2000-2001 crash. Right now, the hackers are leaving Bitcoin and the cryptocurrency space alone because it's one of their own. It's in their club, their private club, if you will. But eventually, the blockchain will be compromised if the CIA doesn't already have a zero-day or backdoor already in place. We just don't know. When that happens, $500 billion will start to rush somewhere.
Well, again, you know, that's why we're looking at gold. And it's been around for, you know, centuries, and it's not going to go anywhere. Also, we're looking at, we're calling for a 10% market correction. We're not looking at a market crash at this time. However, if geopolitical tensions increase to a level beyond sustainability, the markets will crash along with civilization, unfortunately. And this will be the war when they asked Albert Einstein what weapons will be used to fight World War III. He said, I don't know. He said, but they'll be using sticks and stones to fight World War IV. And so that's what we're looking at. If war breaks out between the United States and Iran, it's going to drag in China and Russia. It's going to be the war to really end all wars and much of civilization. So again, you know, when times get tough in any way, markets crash as well. Gold is it's a safe haven commodity, and it's, you know, that's your nuclear shelter in many ways in terms of your nuclear shelter against a financial collapse.
Nuclear shelter, that is a keeper right there. I'm going to quote Il Genio Napolitano. Gold, folks. And remember the brilliant company. I think Einstein was more interesting, the company he kept. I think he would love the Trends Institute, and I think he'd probably be there riding alongside with some of these great minds. Gerald Celente, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Last week, the Dow finished at another 120-plus year record. And of course, the cryptocurrency phenomenon is marching forward. To help discuss some of these topics and much more, Bob Hoy, strategist at institutionaladvisors.com. That's all one word. It's just a pleasure to have him back in rare form, I understand, today.
I decided I'd shave for the interview and make it all very proper.
We've seen the CRB index, the commodity index, breaking down in recent weeks, I think giving some hints or signals that maybe all is not well in the commodity sector. Of course, West Texas has been following that theme downward, and the metals have sagged a bit. Are you looking for a big sell-off?
We got the, what we call our rotation rally for the industrial commodities. We had a rally out in March, and from low is sort of November kind of. And indeed, we did get the rally, and that was it. It actually, some of them, like crude oil, peaked in late February. So then what has happened here is that if you look at the chart at the first of the year, the dollar index was down, the DX. And only one of them was up consistently, and that was gold, although it was a moderate rally. Silver, even more moderate. You know, base metals and crude oil headed down while the dollar was declining, which shows that those industrial commodities really are weak. So what we were looking for on the DX, that probably 96.5 would be the target, and quite likely it would hold, which it has. So, and our we thought it might take about 5 or 6 weeks to complete a base in the U.S. dollar index. And it was more of a decline than a building a base. But nonetheless, the 96.5 held, and we had some technical excesses at the low. So the rally in the U.S. dollar could be quite significant. The first move is refreshing, and then a correction in here, and then the next leg up. So at times like this, it's best to review that the policymakers, their best thing is to have the dollar depreciation. And therefore, the worst thing that can happen for policymakers is that the dollar go up, and indeed it is. And you know, our long-term view on the U.S. dollar heading up for quite some time is based upon the fact that on previous post-bubble contractions, the senior currency has become chronically strong against most other currencies and most commodities. It's the feature of a long contraction following a bubble. And of course, with so many bubbles going on, which is the key bubble in at the time, we thought 2007 bubble was the key one, because
it had residential property up with it, like 1929. It had some firming, pretty good firming with commodity prices. Actually, if you put in crude oil, of course, to 2008, it went crazy. And so we concluded that that had all of the signs of a classic bubble from which the initial collapse was horrendous. Even the establishment noted that it was the worst contraction since the early 1930s. So, hey, this adds up, doesn't it, Chris? A bubble that looked like 1929 and then a contraction that looked like the 1930s. Then, of course, you've had the rebound in the stock market, now to record highs. And we've been taking this as the first bull market out of a classic crash. And now it's really pushed off a whole lot of technical signals. Sentiment and momentum numbers are exceptional. We had one on one stock the other day. I can't remember which one it was, but it gave upside exhaustion signals as well as sequential sell signals. The last time it did that was on March the 8th, 2000, at the height of that bubble. So the excesses are there, only found at cyclical peaks in the market, you know, at or near both. And there's another one, that in the past with great bubbles, and this is now a great bubble, another one actually, they have a tendency in the past to have, in Europe and London, to have peaked in May or June. And that doesn't matter whether it was the South Sea bubble in 1720 or the bubble of 1873. And on the 1873 bubble, the New York market was big enough to be important, but still you could consider it as an immature financial market. Whereas London was the financial capital. So then you have this new phenomenon came in where London and Europe peaked in May or June, turned around through the summer months, and then New York got up and set a speculative high in September of 1873. And then something similar happened in 1929 when London and Europe peaked in May, and then New York turned around during the summer and then made the final high in September. Now, there's one other thing going on here, that on all of those bubbles in the past, like the subsea bubble of 1720 and the huge bubble of 1825, they all were preceded by a long period of dynamic economic expansion that concluded with a huge blowout in commodities. So you had the high for commodities. I mean, we're talking about a generational high in 1711. Then the first stock bubble blew out in 1720. And 1825, it was 9 years earlier on that bubble. And even 1929, well, global commodities in 1920 really did go to the moon. And the crash in commodities in 21 was severe. So severe that the bankers at the Federal Reserve in the mid-20s were very concerned about commodities weakening. So the Fed was easy in monetary policy, concerned about weak commodities. And they didn't understand that the excess credit that might have gone into economic expansion or into commodities, it was time for inflation and financial assets, so the stocks and bonds became the game. So the Fed, in its ignorance, was providing lots of credit, hoping to boost commodity prices, and instead the public had chosen to speculate in stocks, so it added fuel to the fire. So here we are in the last number of years. They've been trying to get the CPI inflation above 2%, which in a way is saying commodity prices are too weak. And I just wrote down a headline about, you know, this thing recently. So the Fed is doing much similar to what they were doing in the 1920s, trying to boost commodity prices when the action is in financial assets. And now, with the Trump phenomenon in the market, you've had a fabulous rally, and we could check that one out because, you know, October is often a month when if there's problems in the market or a bit of down or whatever, it can clear in October and then do the seasonal rally. Now, on our technical work on the S&P, that modest decline into there was gave us a springboard buy. So we thought, okay, now how far can this go? That was on November 3rd, so it was before the election. We thought it could go to around March, mainly because after November, we figured, you know, that industrial commodities would rally anyway. So we got to March, and then there was a bit of a correction down into April, and it gave another springboard buy on the stock market. And I should add, Chris, that this technical tool, the springboard buy, it's designed to only give that signal in a rise when you're in an overall trend in the stock market that's either rising or flat. It doesn't do it in bear market. So anyways, we got the springboard buy in the middle of April and figured, okay, now when is the next high? Well, everybody knows it's going to be in May or June. And of course, with our historical stuff, we knew we had a very strong conviction that the market would run into June. So here's the way we work now is you've got the highs. As a matter of fact, I think I saw a storyline earlier today that in the month of June, you've had the S&P set 7 record highs. And you've got the technicals. So here's where you make a list and you say a checklist for a top. And question number one is the stock market up what it should be? Yes. The next question is, are there signs of speculative excess? Oh, measurably so. It's quite something. Then the third question is, how sound is the fundamental story behind the rally? Well, the fundamental story essentially has been that with the new administration, it's a pro-business administration. And whereas the previous administration was the most anti-business administration since President Wilson. So, yeah, that's the story. And the Trump phenomenon has also brought the public into the market. You can't have a major top in the market without the public getting in and the public are in. And it's funny, even central bankers are in because they really don't understand the meaning of a reserve for the currency, which the central bank should be focused on. Instead, they're practicing modern portfolio theory and trying to get the best return out of their reserve. It's totally insane. So they're long a lot of stocks, particularly the Swiss National Bank, as I read. So you've not only got the public in the stock market, but you've also got the central bankers in. You've had a really good dynamic action in the NASDAQ stocks, you know, the FANG. And I think it was on June 5th we came out with one on the high fires, and there was we had the representative one, and which was Microsoft, and then there was 100 lists of symbols below it that were doing the same sort of blow-off, and so the NASDAQ, these high flyers, have had a correction. But what we're interested in, of course, is always the S&P or representing the broader market or the NYA, which is the whole NYSE. Rolling over. So here's our plan, Chris. Probably in the next week or so, the senior indexes, Dow and S&P, will take a correction as the NASDAQ already has. Then turn around to July, August. The New York market will probably take a run towards another high. Whether it makes it or not, it doesn't matter because it'll probably be the last rally of this bull market. There's now plenty of evidence around to say that this is a cyclical peak.
Bob, I'm not sure if you have access to your email. A few moments ago, I fired over a chart from Zero Hedge. Essentially, it has three currencies, okay? The king of currencies, the yellow metal, Bitcoin, its usurper, the newcomer to the field, and then there is sort of the curmudgeon in the middle, the U.S. dollar, okay? It's really quite an interesting juxtaposition between the three.
Oh, I guess maybe in the last 2 months we've published a chart on the Bitcoin with the big rallies and corrections numbers, and it's matching up with gold in 1980, or if we wanted to, we could do it with RCA in 1929. So it's doing a classic parabolic blow-off, and it's amazing how close it is to gold in 1980. So how far it goes at this stage, we don't know, but it is a blow-off stock.
You know, it's interesting you'd say that because I was in that camp for quite some time. Technically, I'm looking at the chart as well. It's about as vertical as it can be. Or when you see a ram's horn, beware. And we saw that in Bitcoin back near the end of 1980, silver and gold. And you might even say many, many of the IPOs in the late 90s, early 2000s. But my only proviso this time is I actually have become something of a convert in the crypto sphere, that we may still be around circa 1996 in the tulip days, if you will, before we reached the dot bomb. We were still dot com. Firstly, it looks as though, according to a lot of analysis, Bitcoin could consume about 10% of the $5 trillion Forex market, a $500 billion space. They're estimating 30% of that will go to Bitcoin. That's a $1.75 trillion market cap if you multiply by 10. If you adjust the current Bitcoin price, that's about 30 to 40 fold where we are today, which is right in line with Tim Draper, you know, the self-made billionaire VC venture capitalist in Silicon Valley. He's calling for a minimum of $100,000 Bitcoin. And I know that might sound a bit extreme, but he was also calling for $10,000 Bitcoin in 2018. And we're, you might say, one third of the way there already. There are times when the crowd just gets carried away with itself. This could just be the first tulip in Holland where the mania starts to set in. I think the mistake, Bob, people are making is there's a 100 coin or cryptocurrency market out there, meaning that there's at least 100 at any given time that are alternatives to Bitcoin. They are climbing very rapidly, much faster than Bitcoin itself. I think we could have a full-fledged new .com/tulip mania on our hands here that could run another few years.
But these are biological functions, huge growth curves. And when they get going, you just let them go. All we're doing is every once in a while we match it up with gold on the way to 1980. And the matchups have been interesting and the corrections have been interesting. So I'll look at our last one on this kind of a speculative parabolic blow-off. Anything's possible, and you really, this is where I have to agree with the establishment. You can't say a bubble, could never call a bubble a bubble. They came in, and I think it was April of 1720, and the market is flying. But this is when there are a whole lot of new issues being done. And, of course, money was flowing into the new issue. And the guys running the South Sea Company, which was essentially a quasi-government, they became apprehensive because there were a lot of options outstanding that they wanted to get exercised. So then they pushed, there was corruption between the South Sea Company and Parliament. So they pushed through a bill called the Anti-Bubble Act, which was to prevent other stocks from being floated. But by the time they got it in, it was too late anyway. So the government made every effort to keep the South Sea Company flying. And as I said, it went from 120 pounds to 1,000 pounds. I think it was about June the 20th or something like that, very close to now. And that was the high. And then it corrected through the summer and had a little rally into September and then crashed. And every one of the great bubbles since have crashed in the fall.
The one proviso, I would point to a couple of sole survivors from the internet bubble. The reason for the tulip mania is tulips at the time did not breed true. So you weren't sure what you would get. And even if you had a beautiful bulb, you weren't sure if that would actually produce offspring, additional bulbs that would then make you a fortune. The difference, I think, this time, just like in the internet space .com before the .bomb days, you had a handful out of the hundreds of IPOs in that space, and they all went belly up, and we could name Ask Jeeves and so many, or they were absorbed by the big guys, Microsoft, Google, Yahoo, Amazon. I'm going to refer to Bitcoin as the Google. Now, they suffered for quite a while, but they resumed their uptrend and are now up tenfold, 20-fold, 100-fold from where they were at their IPO days. You're seeing the Google, you're seeing the Yahoo, you're seeing the Microsoft, the Netscape. Many will close up shop. Many will be just tokens by the side of the road. Well, all of a sudden, we heard last week, Litecoin shot up because Coinbase, the exchange, decided to start trading it, and everyone in China and Singapore had instantaneous access to Litecoin for the first time. And there is one other interesting difference here. Again, the functionality of Ethereum, which is now its position to eclipse Bitcoin. It was trading at $9 when I was buying it just a few months ago. It's on its way to 9,000. Voting rights, there is increases or decreases in the outstanding float of the coin. That's the tulip that could eclipse even Bitcoin.
Okay, now I sent you the one on the Bitcoin bubble versus gold, Shanghai, and silver. And just to look at the gold and counting the big swings on the way up, we're kind of the equivalent about 600 on gold in 1980 on the way to 800. Exhausts itself and then crashes. And you know, on the way down on these things,
Bitcoin from 2013 to 2017 embedded right next to gold, 73 to 80. So you see two bubbles. But the difference, I would contend that Bitcoin is unshortable. Gold, the central banks now really have virtually all the control because they control the physical and they control the paper. The reason why it's going to 100,000 is that the powers that be are not aware of this yet. They're starting to wake up. I'm sure you read that Vladimir Putin of Russia just met with the Ethereum founder because he wants a Russian cryptocurrency.
Hasn't thought about on the cryptocurrencies is that nobody can short them.
The IPOs, there was no float to short. Only the big underwriter could short. That wasn't in their best interest in most cases. So you saw these tulips fly. Well, today, there's virtually no underwriter. Because what's happened is it's the founders and the small cadre, Silicon Valley startup-like environment in a garage somewhere. They have the entire float. Until that is released, tulip days are here again.
The other things I'll leave you with, Chris, is that any speculation that's done on borrowed money, somewhere out there is lending, borrowing short and lending long. What? The yield curve in China.
Yes, you're right.
It'll keep going so long as the speculation, but the moment the curve will begin to change, maybe a week or so before the price on whatever is being speculated in. So, and then the other one is the gold-silver ratio. It can change. Well, as a matter of fact, it's been rising, which suggests that whatever the big speculation is now, becoming vulnerable. But when? You never know. This thing could run for months.
Bob, tell people more about why they really must get a hold of your information. And plus, I promise to post this link of the updated Bitcoin bubble versus gold, Shanghai, and silver.
Yeah, you can run that chart. Yeah, it's institutionaladvisors.com, or you can actually just Google my name, Bob Hoy, and it all comes up. And I can say that our work is very reliable. We put in accolades and kudos on the front page of our on the home page of our site, and we've got them from some people in the business, Jim Grant, Grant's Trade Advisor, stuff like that. So we're pleased with the work that we do, and we're pleased to share it for our subscription fee. So
well, hopefully we'll talk again soon.
Very good, thank you, Chris. Anytime. Look forward.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. In case you haven't noticed, the quest for personal relevance is underway in full force throughout mainstream media, throughout Hollywood, and throughout the halls of Congress. Self-importance reigns supreme amongst many reporters, celebrities, and elected officials who continue to echo one another day after repetitive day in what has evolved from whining to recreational complaining about the results of the 2016 presidential election. Yes, they play a big role in controlling the narrative, the airwaves, and the politics. And despite as much as 93% negative news reporting on the current White House, and despite violent and grotesque shock value masquerading as political discourse and free speech, those who beat the drums of resistance, and make no mistake, it is a bipartisan resistance, those who seek their identity through resistance and obstruction do so at their own peril, because they forget the great lesson of history, in that it's not enough to be against something or someone. You have to know what you stand for, what your alternative vision and plan represents. Otherwise, you resist inside a vacuum, and you will get sucked away in your own chaos. This is what's happening right now. The more noise mainstream media, fading Hollywood celebrities, and a segment of our political class who should have long ago retired, the more noise they make, the less impact they seem to be having, which is why they continue to make more and more noise. But is anybody really listening? $55 million was spent in the special congressional election in Georgia, making it the most expensive House race in history. The mainstream media, Hollywood, and many in Congress proclaimed this was the turning point. Just like in the 2016 presidential election, they vociferously proclaimed poll results that never came to pass, calling into severe question the integrity of, not the election, but all those who have invested their worldview in a system that has already changed, a public that has already changed, and ideas that have already changed. Remember, it's not enough to be against something or someone. You have to know what you stand for. The great miscalculation of the past decade has been all those people, families, and businesses who were savaged by the cruelty of the 2008 economic collapse. All those individuals in their 50s who were downsized and never regained their employment status at a level where they could maintain their former selves. All those people who lost their retirements and pensions. All those people who lost homes due to fraud that went unpunished in the banking sector, and whose homes were eventually bought up by Fed-backed rescue measures, not for the benefit of homeowners, but for the benefit of banks. And now that very same Fed is attempting to divest itself of all those assets it acquired from Mid-America. All the denial of this crisis and its true lingering implications have gone unnoticed, unpolled, and unrecognized by media, Hollywood, and many in Congress. They believe the enumeracy myth, that unemployment is actually under 5%, when it's actually more in the 20% range. They have believed their own financial lies and their own wishful polling based on an unrepresented demographic of people who have structurally changed their lives and their vision of what's needed in the future. And it's this change, whose ground zero was October of 2008, that the media, Hollywood, and politicians have missed and continue to ignore, that is driving the change they can no longer control. The whining rhetoric and recreational complaining that is growing so tiresome is actually the sound of obsolescence, searching for relevance it can never reclaim. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.